From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is making another one of those awful pilgrimages, this time to Orlando to console families of victims from Sunday's mass shooting. And the investigation into the mass shooting that took their loved ones continues. Senator Ron Johnson, chair of the Senate Homeland Security Committee, has written to Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg outlining information about the shooter's motives and asking Facebook to release all data on Omar Mateen's use of the site. NPR's Nathan Rott is in Orlando. And Nathan, can you first tell us more about what was in that letter?
Yeah, certainly. The letter says that Mateen used Facebook, quote, before and during the attack to search for and post terrorism-related content. Mateen was apparently associated with five different Facebook accounts. That's according to the letter, which and research that was done by investigators with the Department of Homeland Security and Government Affairs. Mateen allegedly used one of those profiles during the actual attack Sunday morning to search for the words shooting and Pulse Orlando, which is, of course, the name of the nightclub where he killed 49 people. The letter also says that Mateen posted about American and Russian airstrikes against the Islamic State the morning before the attack, and a final posting that read, "In the next few days, you will see attacks from the Islamic State in the USA." The other allegation to come out of this letter is a claim that Mateen searched for information about San Bernardino shooters in the days before the attack and for information on federal and local law enforcement offices in Orlando, which would seem to indicate that he had certainly done his homework before committing this horrific attack.
And what about the latest on the investigation into his wife? Now, we've heard conflicting reports about her being aware of his intentions, trying to stop him, or of simply going to the club, well, not simply, but going to the Pulse Club with her husband before Sunday morning. A grand jury was convened. What do we know?
Yeah, there's been a lot of conflicting reports out there. And honestly, investigators have been pretty tight-lipped about her, as they have been about the entire investigation, really. There hasn't been much new information about Mateen, his movements before the attack, his motives. And in terms of his wife, we do know that investigators are talking to her for any information she might have about her husband and whether or not she did know anything about his attack before. There are those reports, like you mentioned, that she had driven her husband to Pulse in the weeks before the attack and that she was with him when he bought the guns he used. We have not confirmed those, though. We do not know that. There are other reports that she's given conflicting statements about how much she knew to investigators while she's talked to him. We do know that a U.S. attorney is planning to bring evidence to a grand jury to determine whether or not charges will be brought against her, though.
Yeah. Well, Orange County's chief medical officer, Joshua Stephanie, whose sad job it is to shepherd these bodies now, the 49 bodies from the club and another body of the shooter, obviously, to their resting place. He's spoken for the first time. He talked about seeing the scene in the club, as he said, frozen in time, bills not paid, food not eaten, about how out of respect they are keeping the shooter's body separate from his victims. And he talked to CNN about speaking with victims' families. Let's listen.
The most common question is, did my loved one suffer? And honestly, 99 out of 100 times, that is the question they ask. In cases such as this, I will tell them, I don't think they suffered one bit. I didn't see any evidence of movement or trying to struggle. It, like I said, in the beginning, when I got in there in the scene, it's almost like everyone just stopped and laid down where they were.
No, terrible. But do we know any more about when funerals for those victims might be?
Yeah, we know that there are two planned for Saturday. Those are the ones that we know of. There are probably more. Half of the victims were from Puerto Rico or at least had ties to Puerto Rico, so we know that many of the bodies are being returned to the island for burial. There was a really beautiful profile, actually, of one of the victims, 28-year-old Angel Candelario Padro, earlier this morning by one of our colleagues that kind of talked about his family's efforts to get him back to Puerto Rico for burial. I mean, one thing we should just say, though, is you have to remind you that there, you know, 49 people died. That's 49 funerals to plan, 49 funerals to carry out, 49 families that are grieving. And that's a lot, you know, for any community, whether we're talking about Puerto Ricans, the gay community, or even just the whole city of Orlando and the people here that knew these people.
Yeah. I mean, from everything from supplying coffins to flowers. I mean, it's just a huge effort and a huge emotional stress. And Nathan, you give us the opportunity to remind people that there are several GoFundMe accounts set up for people trying to send bodies home just within this country and pay for their families, their loved ones' funerals. NPR national reporter Nathan Roth, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Robin.
As many as 80 people are dying every day in this country from drug overdoses. And we've talked a lot about efforts to deal with the opioid crisis. But in the fight against people illegally cooking drugs like meth, there's a new tool. Lauren Silverman from NPR station KERA in Dallas reports.
It's a Monday morning, and someone's getting ready to cook a batch of the illegal drug PCP near the University of North Texas in Denton.
He's getting everything geared.
Tell him to go out there and gear it all up anyway.
That's Guido Verbeck. He's a forensic scientist and professor at UNT. We're in the backseat of a hybrid Ford Fusion, driving to an empty trailer home that looks abandoned. That's where the cook, as they call it, is about to go down. Verbeck doesn't work in law enforcement, though he definitely looks the part. He's got a clean-shaven head and rugged cowboy boots. No, we're here to test out a drug detection device Verbeck created. It's a big black metal machine sitting where the front seat should be. It's called a mobile mass spectrometer, but in this case, it's a drug sniffer.
The truth of the matter with this car is it's like a dog. The chemistry has to go into the nose.
Two hidden pipes are sucking in air from the outside. One's by the rearview mirror, and another is down by the fog light. The pipes feed the air to the device's nose, so to speak. It's a tool scientists use to measure the mass of different molecules. The mass can reveal the identity of the molecule. For example, carbon has a mass of 12, meth, 149. Here's the thing, though. The device isn't searching for meth or PCP exactly. It's searching for the chemicals, the ingredients, used to make those drugs.
It's looking for pyridine, piperidine, all of the chemicals that would be required in making the process. Most of the time we say that the drug dealers are some of the best capitalists. Once the drug is made, it's on the street. So what you really need to do is to train a lot of these labs and portable labs to look for the precursor items, to know that that type of activity is going on, because the drug's probably not there.
Inside the trailer house, UNT PhD candidate Ethan McBride is pulling out his ingredients. He's placing glass beakers on the grimy bathroom sink and a hot plate on top of the toilet tank.
So this is the precursor to PCP, angel dust. This one's incredibly easy to make.
Bride says this really is a typical setup for a clandestine drug cook, and he's gotten used to handling controlled substances, even though cooking drugs was never on his bucket list.
I think it's important to be able to put yourself into the mind of the clandestine chemist because, of course, generally these are not classically trained chemists, but they are very good at what they do. I do think that they come up with very creative solutions sometimes, and so I think we have to be equally as creative to catch them.
While the hydrochloric acid and piperidine spin in the beaker, Guido Verbeck is circling around in the car, watching a graph on a digital screen that looks like a GPS display. That's where we'll see signs of the chemicals seeping out the front door and bathroom window. Sure enough, as soon as we circle around the back of the trailer and the air enters the sniffing device...
You see couple of the heavier peaks?
Digital peaks and valleys pop up on the screen. It's like we're monitoring the heart rate of the chemicals in the air.
The wind's kind of blowing this way today, and so you can see that the heavier peaks will get more intense when you get in and out of that stream. And as we drive away, it's going to start getting lower.
Verbeck has already partnered with the Denton County Sheriff's Department and is talking with federal law enforcement about using the device. He hopes to make the graph easier to read so first responders who aren't trained in forensic science can clearly see if there are dangerous chemicals in the air or if someone's illegally cooking drugs. And get this, Verbeck even imagines putting the device in a self-driving car. No officer inside.
Where a person doesn't have to put themselves in danger. So if they drive by it and it looks like there's a drug cook going on, they can just keep going, send that data back to the officers, and they can come on the scene.
Sniffing out illegal activity from a drive-by could be a great tool for police. But Eric Sterling says the technology walks a fine line between empowering law enforcement and protecting privacy. He's executive director of the Criminal Justice Policy Center in Silver Spring, Maryland.
what we think of as notions of privacy, that you can do various activities outside the public eye and get away with it, those ideas are being demolished both by technology and by law.
Sterling doubts that a map showing chemicals concentrated around a house would be enough to get a search warrant. But he says a judge might give the go-ahead if there were other clues.
You want to have surveillance that perhaps might show unusual kinds of pedestrian traffic for the location, run checks on the vehicles of the people who drive in and out, identify them, find out if they're criminal records.
In addition to sniffing out criminals, there are potentially less controversial uses for the device. Sterling and Verbeck say environmental cleanup crews, even firefighters, could use it to identify chemicals floating in the air from a safe distance. For Here and Now, I'm Lauren Silverman in Dallas.
All this week, we're talking about science. Yesterday, we looked at how well we're doing as a country teaching young people about science and how to get more women and minorities into STEM fields. Today, what about us adults? How much do American adults know about basic science, and does it matter? Joining us is Chad Orzel, associate professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Union College in Schenectady, New York. He's also the author of Eureka, Discovering Your Inner Scientist, and How to Teach Physics to Your Dog, among other books. Chad Orzel, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, how scientifically literate would you say that most Americans are at this point? How do we measure something like that?
So most of the discussions of science literacy in the general public refer to these surveys that have been done for about 30 years now, where they ask people on the street a bunch of true-false questions about basic facts about science. And on those, people do reasonably well. The average score is somewhere, 70%, something like that. And these are very basic facts that they're asking about, things like is the center of the Earth very hot, or does the Earth go around the sun, or vice versa, things like that. So these are fairly basic facts that they're quizzing people about to see how much people know.
Well, and in fact, we actually did a little quizzing of our own. We went out and asked people what they know about certain scientific subjects, and here's what they told us.
Anthony Sheffield. One thing I remember is, and I don't know if it was from the course, but there's cone snails in Australia.
Rachel Myers, evolution. That it's the theory of evolution, and it's important, and that's how we got here. that's it.
John Goodwin, physics is life. Physics is everything. Physics is the fundamental rules and definitions that hold the world together.
I'm Vivek Conley, and I'm an real estate assistant. Biology. I really don't know. That's really how useful it was in my life.
Joe Camp, computer science is what, artificial intelligence or the internet? What are we looking at, satellite?
So how does that stack up with the rest of the surveys that are being done?
It's interesting. I mean, people don't do as well as we might like on these questions of sort of very basic knowledge. I'm not sure how big a problem that is, though, because these questions, while they're fairly basic and you would like to have people get them correct and, show that they're aware of modernity, ultimately science is more about the process of science than any particular collection of basic facts.
What do you mean the process of science?
So the essential nature of science is it's a means of generating reliable information about the world. And, you can get really complicated with it, but I like to think of it as a four-step process that you look at the world around you, you think about why it might work the way that it does, come up with some sort of model. Then you test that model by making further observations and experiments. And once you have a model that works and that agrees with reality and passes your tests, then you tell everybody you know the results of that test. And that process is the really fundamental thing. That's how we know that the Earth goes around the sun, is that people looked at the world, made observations of the motion of the sun and the motion of other objects, and developed this model of the Earth going around the sun. Then they thought about, okay, what other results would that predict? What does that help us explain? And they went out and it passes every observational test that you can come up with. And then that's been disseminated very widely to the point where, 70, 80% of people in the world are accurately aware that the Earth goes around the sun rather than vice versa.
But you don't have that same percentage, at least here in the United States, of people believing in the science that scientists are telling us about global climate change.
Yeah, there's a really interesting problem with these highly politically charged questions, things like climate change, or the other one that comes up a lot is evolution. And there's some interesting things where what you end up surveying is less people's knowledge of science than people's beliefs about politics. They did an interesting experiment with one of these surveys a few years ago where they have a question on that asks human beings as we know them today developed from earlier species of animals. True or false? And if they ask that just to people on the street in the U.S., about 48% of people say that humans evolved from earlier animals. But if you preface that question with, according to the theory of evolution, human beings as we know them today developed from earlier species, that number goes up to about 72%. Hmm. So a large part of what you're testing is people's personal belief and sort of tribal identification for political reasons. And so they answer that question differently depending on whether you ask them, you know, do you believe this or do scientists believe this? So people actually have better knowledge of science than we think.
But many people would look at that and say that is a question of science literacy, because if people had more knowledge of the science of it, it wouldn't get political or it wouldn't have to do with what the religion was, because they would, in those cases, just look at the facts.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of research in psychology showing that that's kind of a problematic belief, that providing people with factual information is not actually as good a way of changing their opinions about things as you would think, which is unfortunate, but you know, it's the way that people work.
So how do we compare with the rest of the world when it comes to knowledge of science among the general population?
I think it's fascinating to look at comparing to the rest of the world, because one of my favorite questions on the survey is true or false, lasers work by focusing sound waves. And in the United States, about 50% of people get that right, which is equivalent to guessing. But it's interesting that we're among the world's leaders in that question.
And by the way, the correct response is?
The correct response is false. Lasers have nothing to do with sound waves.
All right.
So, you know, for all that we hear that American education is uniquely bad, or that, you know, we're getting our clock cleaned by Japan and Korea and China, you know, we're actually competitive with them in terms of these sort of basic societal knowledge of fundamental scientific facts.
Well, how much do people who aren't scientists need to know to get by in the course of their lives? Do we know enough, or would you prefer that the general population know a bit more about science in order to just operate?
I think, you know, for a lot of these facts, it doesn't make a great deal of difference to the average person on the street whether the Earth goes around the sun or the sun goes around the Earth. That's not really going to change anybody's daily life very much. But knowing the process of science is something that's extremely useful, because it's the most reliable tool we have for generating accurate information. But I think that people actually do have a much better knowledge of that than we appreciate, because that process is sort of fundamental to, you know, almost everything that we do. You know, if you have a job that is more complicated than digging holes and filling them back in, you probably at some point are using a scientific reasoning process. You're looking at a problem that you have to solve. You're thinking about a way to solve that problem. And you're trying things out to come up with a solution that works. And then, you know, when it does, then you share that solution with other people. That's something that everybody does all the time, every day. We just don't necessarily think of it as scientific.
There's also the issue of science being intimidating to some people, that they don't want to learn more about it because it's so difficult to understand sometimes.
Yeah, and you know, people will complain about the fact that science relies on math, or that science has a lot of technical jargon. There are a couple of you know, good rejoinders to that. One of which is, you know, if you look at things like fantasy sports or just sports in general, right? You can go on ESPN or listen to sports talk radio, and you'll find people having these intricately mathematical arguments about, you know, advanced metrics and measurements measuring the performance of players in the NBA and, you know, is Steph Curry really better than Michael Jordan in his prime and that kind of thing, where people happily throw around all sorts of numbers at a fairly high level of mathematical sophistication, more than you would expect from the sort of the popular image of sports fans. So I think that, you know, things like mathematics and even some of the jargon, that has a reputation of being intimidating. But when properly motivated, people are perfectly capable of dealing with those things.
Do you think that there are a whole bunch of little Einsteins out there right now that if only we were putting them in the right place in terms of what they're learning and what's motivating them and what's inspiring them, that they would be able to develop all kinds of new scientific advances?
I think there are certainly people out there who are going to make the scientific advances of the future. The question is, you know, how well are we doing at properly identifying those? And, you know, there are a lot of sort of subtle biases that cut against doing a good job of that. You know, we have a lot of issues with class and race and gender in science, and sort of almost subliminally promoting a message that, you know, only certain kinds of people can do science, which is nonsense if you look at it historically. There have been, you know, great discoveries in science made by people of all sorts of ethnic backgrounds, all sorts of, you know, men and women, people from all different countries, people from all different cultures. Science is a very universal thing. It's just we frequently do a bad job of conveying that information.
That's Chad Orzel, who's an associate professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Union College in Schenectady, New York. Chad Orzel, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. It's fun.
Let's take a break from the news now. One way people might try to do that tonight is with a big game. The Golden State Warriors can wrap up their second straight NBA championship with a win over the Cleveland Cavaliers in Cleveland. The Warriors lead the best-of-seven series 3-2, but of course the Cavs avoided elimination with a 112-97 Game 5 win over Golden State Monday night. They could hold them off for Game 6, too, which the sponsors would love. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, what do you make of this series so far? Because none of the games has been like a nail biter.
Right. But overall, in totality, it has been. It is funny how you say hold them off. And that's how I think people are thinking of the series. Like, well, of course, the Warriors are going to win, or they seem like the inevitable team. But then every once in a while, the Cavs do something like win by 30, or LeBron James has a 25-point first half. But I don't think we've gotten to the point where people are saying, well, the Cavs can really win this. If they win tonight and if there is a game 7, how could you not say that?
Yeah. Well, if you were a fan. So it's been like a big seesaw. You know, it hasn't been, as you say, like each game is a nail biter. But in totality, there's been this back and forth. The two big stars, the Warriors' Steph Curry, Cleveland's LeBron James, each have had great games, though. James, 41 points in the Cavs game 5. Curry, 38 in Golden State's game 4. So is that the micro of all of this? Who's the better player?
I don't think so. I don't think that this is a referendum on that. I mean, it's a team sport for all those reasons. But also, I'd say this. LeBron James has such a complete game, and he has the second most assists he will after tonight in the entire playoffs, and the second most rebounds, and he has the second most steals of any player in the playoffs. Steph Curry is a scorer, a great scorer. Mm-hmm. That's why he's a deserving MVP. But, you know, in these playoffs, Curry is scoring 0.2 points more than LeBron James. And when LeBron went off in game 5, and when he scored his 25 first half points, he put the other facets of his game facilitating for his teammates sort of in his back pocket, thereby showing how much he brings. We were all saying, what a great game, one of the greatest games ever, because he's scoring. I think we get scoring's the most important thing, but it's not the only important thing. And let's not get blind to all the other contributions, especially on defense LeBron makes.
Right. I just weigh in on this controversy, though, and I'm going to make it a controversy. The Warriors, Draymond Green, missed game 5 because he was suspended by the NBA after flagrant foul against LeBron James in game 4. Green says Golden State would have won 5 if he'd played, but conspiracy theorists, you know, go further. They say the NBA suspended him to extend the series.
Yes, conspiracy theorists do say that. And I would not expect Draymond Green to say anything other than, well, without me, of course, they'd win. But by letter of the law, he had committed these fouls, and that is the accumulative penalty for these fouls. And so here we are in game 6. Perhaps they added a little more drama. And if the Warriors win, will they be really upset that it dragged out a bit longer and their time in the sun was a bit brighter?
Okay, call it.
I don't know. I think it will go to game seven. Why not? Maybe that's hope over experience.
And then seven.
I could see it. Yeah, and then maybe we'll have a good game, too. No, again, hope over experience. I think the Warriors eventually win, though.
Okay, direct all of your email to Mike Pesca, Hear No Sports Analyst, who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thank you for this break from the news. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
This week, the round-the-clock coverage of the mass shooting in Orlando morphed into coverage of the debate on gun rights, in particular, the military-style rifles used in the devastating assault on the Pulse nightclub. And it became emotional at times. Here's CNN's Anderson Cooper, who is openly gay, reading victims' names.
Antonio Devon Brown was a captain in the, was a captain in the U.S. Army Reserve and a graduate of Florida A&M. He was 29, Alejandro Barrios Martinez. Mm.
So how did the media do?
Let's bring in David Folkenflik, media correspondent at NPR. Hi, David.
Hey, guys.
And what stands out to you and your thoughts generally on the media coverage this week?
Well, I think that it was a moment often of emotion. You know, this was a terrible massacre. Of innocence. And you could hear that reflected in Anderson Cooper's voice. You could hear that reflected in the ways in which a number of anchors and made the decision consciously to cite the names of victims, but not invoke or infrequently invoke the name of the shooter, the killer. That was a conscious decision. I think as our head of news, Mike Oreskes, has said, the identity of the killer is news and newsworthy, but not to dwell in some ways. I think as a decision by many news organizations was a conscious one and in some ways a smart one. It evoked for me in some ways, thinking back to Hurricane Katrina, the outrage and the pain that was often articulated by journalists, many of whom came up in a tradition of just the facts, and at the same time found themselves confronted by human and terrible moments and shared that with their audiences. So I think you saw that. I think you also saw, as you suggested in the introduction, Robin, that there were people who said, you know, maybe we need to think hard about guns. There's the front page of the Boston Globe, an editorial that simply says, make it stop, with what I believe to be an AK-15 pointing upward on it, and the size of an actual bullet hole.
Right. It's a full wraparound on the Boston Globe. It's the front page. And you can see it at my Twitter feed at Here Now Robin. It's the full front page, but then also inside there's report. It's quite something. But you mentioned Katrina, David, and I want to pick up there because Anderson Cooper was, of course, pivotal during Hurricane Katrina and has been very provocative in many ways this week, prompting, I should say, a lot of emotion. His interview with Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi went viral. She was there in the interview live to talk about fundraising for the, or rather not live, I think they edited it, to talk about fundraising for the victims. He reminded her that when she argued against gay marriage in court for the state, she said gays would be bad for Florida. Let's listen to a little of that exchange.
Today's right. about victims.
It's about gay and lesbian
here.
Victims.
It sure is. Right. LGBT right. victims.
I'm just wondering, is it hypocritical to portray yourself as a champion of the gay community when I'm just reflecting what a lot of gay people have told me they don't see you as
Anderson,
that.
Anderson, I'm not portraying myself as anything other than trying to help human beings.
And then David Folkenflik, some have asked, is he able to be objective? He's openly gay, but Anderson Cooper was as angry with a public official during Katrina. So, and he's adamant he's not an activist. Your thoughts?
Well, look, I mean, Anderson Cooper is gay. People who are straight have their own sexual orientation. We don't ask whether or not they can be impartial or, right. or thoughtful journalists in that instance. I think that, you know, Anderson Cooper cited many gay people he talked to in the immediate aftermath of the shooting and said, you know, they were angry at Pam Bondi, the attorney general of Florida, because they felt she was hypocritical. At the same time, there's no way to doubt for a second that this reflects Anderson Cooper's own belief. It drove him. It was an intense exchange spanning a number of minutes on live cable news. He really pressed her. In some ways, you could argue it wasn't an entirely fair interview. It certainly wasn't what she was prepared for. She seemed utterly ill-equipped to deal with the fact that she was expressing sympathy for people for whom she had not expressed much shared affinity or humanity in the past. And at the same time, I think it's fair to say that there are public officials who may not support a number of public policy positions that many gays may adamantly want, who may still feel compassion, empathy, and anger over what happened and may perhaps share some common desire for policies that might help prevent such outcomes in the future. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a complex thing, but I think Anderson Cooper basically has been given leeway by CNN to have a voice and a thought to how he approaches certain stories. This is definitely among them. It is close to heart, right, but also I think from a human level.
Well, I would also say that you could make the same argument about an African-American covering the shooting of Michael Brown or anything like that. Why shouldn't they be able to cover it in the same way that anybody else would be
the massacre at the African-American church in Charleston a year ago. I think it absolutely should
And express
never
person,
preclude you know, a journalist from the ability to do that.
Or
it's
expressing
personal
emotion that they, you know, they, why would they want to hide it? It's just being human.
But there's something else that's been brought up here, David, which in terms of Pam Bondi coming on to talk about raising money for the victims, there are a lot of people, it seems, this week that have come out who in the past would have been seen as having anti-gay positions who want to come out and talk right now about how much they feel for the victims of this tragedy. And what is the responsibility of the news organization there when it comes to giving people the ability to come out and speak? Maybe it's somebody from the Catholic Church. Maybe it's somebody who – there's an Orthodox rabbi who's come out and said very nice things and he wants to go to a gay bar. But at the same time – you know, do you need to bring up those things from the past that these people may have said?
The impact of their faith, too.
Right.
Yeah.
It's certainly an issue that's absolutely fair to explore. I mean, you don't want to hold that person personally accountable for the deaths. And at the same time, I think we can recognize that, you know, perhaps humanity should not be expressed only in the face of abject horror. There was an incredibly moving public statement by the I believe the lieutenant governor of Utah
right,
who came forward and talked about how he had been homophobic in the past and expressed sentiments from as being a very young man, a youth, to being an adult that were anti-gay, and the ways in which this made him really revisit that. And it was an incredibly compelling thing. I do think there are enough different kinds of news organizations out there that not all of them have to perform the same function. But I think it's absolutely an issue legitimate to explore. Yeah. And you talk about moments of humanity. You know, earlier, you know, Scott Pelley of the CBS News was interviewing one of the victims who was in the club
survivor.
And who was able to get out a survivor in his life with his life, and at the same time whose close friend, whom he described as essentially a little brother, did not survive, and how he wished he could have done more. And Scott Pelley put his hand forward and said, "You couldn't have done anything more. Mm-hmm. There was nothing you could do." And the man, you know, continued to weep visibly and very forcefully, and Pelley again said, "There was nothing you could have done." Now, maybe you don't need an anchor with a voice so commanding, a voice of authority so strong to absolve him and expiate him. Maybe that's not a journalist's role, but it was an incredibly humane moment where he's trying to let the person know, you know, human to human, that you can't carry this blame on yourself through your life. And I thought that was very compelling.
Boy, I think if you don't do that, you're remiss. But that's – we could spend a whole other – segment on that, and maybe a whole other segment on this, because there was a time in, you know, in our country's history where you would have felt that you had to have somebody come forward to say why they felt that gays should not have rights and should not have sympathy. And we have this other conversation now going on about guns. When do you know you're at a tipping point in that conversation? I mean, we've been at tipping points before about cigarettes, for instance. You would have had to have somebody on from the tobacco industry if you were talking about cigarettes. They would have been allowed time to say, we don't think they cause cancer. You would have had somebody – you would have had to have somebody come on about climate change, global warming, to say, you know, we don't think that it's happening. And then there becomes a tipping point. There are some people who feel we might be approaching that tipping point this week on assault weapons, that there is sort of a moment where you know, you might be tipping into that category of, do you need somebody to defend these weapons? I've only left you a minute for this, but how
well,
do you know?
we've hit an interesting moment. You would have thought this came after the Gabby Giffords shootings and shootings of others in Arizona. You would have thought after Newtown. You would have thought after the Virginia Tech shootings that if there were to be a moment, there would be a moment that people would coalesce around this. But, you know, this week, Gretchen Carlson of Fox News, not a channel known for hostility to gun owners or gun rights, she said she thought it was time for there to be a ban on the kind of a semi-automatic weapons as was used down in Orlando at the Pulse Club. And that is she's not the most influential figure there, but it's striking to have any anchor or host do that from Fox News. You're starting to hear that from certain journalists asking the question again and again. You heard it from late night comic hosts. And I think that's a through line to a lot of what you've heard over the week from the media.
David, we're going to have to take this. Let's take this up again because I'm fascinated by it. You know, when do you make those decisions?
Well, and we'll continue this conversation at our website, hereandnow.org. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you so much.
You bet.
We are also joined for a little moment of joy here by our resident chef, Kathy Guns, to talk about strawberries.
She just ran into the studio during the break.
Seasonal red joy. Oh,
it's needed. It's much needed. Okay, make your case. Strawberries.
Make your case.
Well, it's hard to feel sad when there's a ripe, seasonal, luscious, juicy, sweet strawberry in front of you. And you have many. These are from a local farm in southern Maine. They are popping up all over the country. On the West Coast, they're winding down. But boy, they are something special.
The aroma.
I know, right? Yeah. It's almost floral. It's pretty special. And before we get into the food, I just quickly want to tell you that I did an experiment last night which blew my mind because they were so fresh and ripe. I didn't want to refrigerate them, but I took one box and put it in the refrigerator and kept one out. The refrigerator kills it.
Mm. It does.
Strawberries in the refrigerator.
No, deal is to go buy them fresh and cook them that night. You can keep them out for 1 day, 2 days. If you start to see mold, it's gone too far. Mm. But they started to taste like winter strawberries. But let's get to the important stuff.
I have to just say, you know what? What's her name told me?
What's her name?
Julia Child.
Oh, her.
Told me strawberries and tomatoes, you put them in the fridge, it robs them of that extra.
Exactly. It is so true about tomatoes, too. And the other thing is, you don't want to be running them under a lot of cold running water. They are little red, beautiful sponges, and they will absorb whatever you put on it. So you want to look for organic strawberries. You want to know the farm you bought them from because they will also absorb pesticides. But let's talk about the beauty of the sweetness. You're starting with the salad. Very good choice.
And you can see pictures of this, by the way, at hereandnow.org. We've got all the recipes and the photos. Mm-hmm. Yes, the salad.
So this is unexpected because I don't love strawberries in savory foods, but this I love. This is arugula and some different spicy greens from my garden. I took the strawberries and I roasted them at a high temperature. I sprinkled them with a teaspoon of sugar just to heighten the sweetness. 12 minutes. And all of this tastes so strawberries. They become buttery, and they're like uber sweet and super interesting.
Yeah, you roast them, but they're not crispy. They're buttery.
Yes, they become buttery, the texture, and you could use that on grilled fish or grilled chicken. These roasted strawberries. You can also grill strawberries. They are highly adaptable, but they're really nice with the spicy arugula and the greens.
I love these kinds of salads. They're somewhat sweet. I like to put raisins and cheese.
Nice. Some soft goat cheese. Walnuts would be really nice.
The dressing?
The dressing is reduced balsamic vinegar, that thick, sticky balsamic vinegar, and good olive oil. That's it.
Oh, boy.
Nothing else.
Okay.
Okay, let's move on to this, Kathy.
You both picked a different plate.
No, we'll go with this.
This is for the non-cooks. This is as simple as it gets. You buy your beautiful strawberries. You eat them all day. You put them on your yogurt, your pancakes, your toast. This is from a restaurant that used to be in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, called the Blue Strawberry. Mm. And my friend, Chef James Haller, every single day for all the years that restaurant was open, this was the only dessert they served. Strawberries dipped into sour cream and then into brown sugar. So what you have on the plate are these beautiful ripe strawberries with a mound of sour cream and then the brown sugar.
Do it yourself.
It's a do-it-yourself dessert. It's about as perfect as it gets.
Wow. Okay, well.
Until you taste the next strawberry shortcake. Yes, so this is a buttermilk biscuit that I am quite proud of. It's taken me way too many decades to perfect the biscuit. This has buttermilk. The dough gets folded onto itself. You'll see all the directions. But it is everything a biscuit should be, which is to say light and fluffy. Mm. It's got vanilla-scented whipped cream. I macerated some strawberries. Scary word. All it means is I sliced them last night, sprinkled them with a little sugar, and they just are oozing with juice today.
I don't want this to sound like delicious dish, but I really just – it's like I just want to make like sounds right now. It's
so good. I give you permission.
But we know they annoy, those sounds annoy people, so we apologize. But
except that they can make them so easily. All these recipes.
Well, I just want to say, when you said it's the perfect what is this thing
biscuits.
Called? It's a perfect biscuit. I can hear all of our listeners all across the South saying, oh, yeah?
Oh, good.
But let me tell
Bring
you.
Bring it on.
Send us yours. Please send us your recipes.
Not the actual biscuits.
This is the recipe. To hearandnow.org. But I got to tell you, this is light. It's a little bit sweet, but not too sweet.
And the buttermilk really
crispy
gives it
on
a
the
light.
Outside.
Exactly.
Oh.
And just golden brown. You know, I see these pre-made biscuits in stores and I think, okay, I know everyone's crazed for time. The best thing about these biscuits, you make a batch, you get 10 biscuits, you put them in your freezer, and you can just pop them out as you want them. Two tonight, one for breakfast on Sunday. That's it.
Just want to ask you one last thing. Is this a jam you made? What is this?
No, that's a strawberry rhubarb sauce.
Oh, that's
I forgot.
Rhubarb syrup.
Again, four ingredients, 5 minutes. Great addition to those shortcakes.
It's amazing. And we'll have all the recipes. And so get there fast because we guarantee the website will crash. No, it won't. It won't. It'll handle it. But everyone will go to get them and you will be happy. And again, send us yours, right?
I'd love to see people's biscuit recipes. Yeah. But try mine before you badmouth it.
Send us all your strawberry-related recipes.
You know, Kathy, I just got some cherries the other day. Now we've got to do a segment on cherries.
Oh, I love cherries. Cherry season is here.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I will say thank you to you, Kathy Gunst.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.